Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. There was a time, up to a few decades ago, when critics of the Church would point their finger in scorn and claim that the Church, with its carefully articulated moral ethics, was just obsessed with sex. And the answer usually came back, no, it isn't us, it's you. And it is now perfectly clear that it was secular society that was both obsessed by sex and also addicted to it. But its obsession has taken the form of a narrowing of its vision rather than an expanding of it. And so we might say, perhaps, that the Church has come into its own now as one of the very few competing philosophies with a narrative about sex, sexuality and relationships between the sexes sufficiently coherently worked out to provide an antidote to our experience of this secular fundamentalism. Faced by a culture that has been so intellectually infantilized that it can't answer the question of what is a woman without collapsing in category confusion, it's time the Church shook off the old accusations and placed its competence, wisdom, and functional expertise on the table. Contemporary secularism was ill-served by Protestantism's visceral reaction against and rejection of Mary and all things feminine. For 1500 years, the Holy Spirit had crafted a careful complementarity between the male and the female following the Incarnation, only to have it junked by the incompetence of that 16th century reform movement. It's no surprise today that young women the world over find themselves fighting the sterile monochrome power play of contemporary feminism in any of its present stages, only to be set free by a vision of Mary, the mother of our Lord. Megan Madden is one of those women and has written a lucid and highly accessible book explaining why Mary, Mother of Christ and of the Church, plays such a restorative and healing role, not only in the journey of the soul, but also in this politicized instability and anarchy of gender confusion which marks our contemporary culture. I'm very pleased to say she joins me now. Megan, thank you so much for joining me. I've just finished reading your book and I enjoyed it so much. It does what it says on the tin. It introduces you to Our Lady and takes you through the different stages of her life and moving from her actions to her role, and a role that she invites us in some extent to take part in. One of the best ways, I think, to start the conversation would be to ask you about you. Have you always been a Catholic? Why do you do what you do? Why Our Lady? And then we might begin to unfold some of the things both you've written in the book, and I very much hope some of the people who've influenced you on the journey. So, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here. I'm so happy to be here and just so honored to be on the podcast. My name's Megan Madden. I am a wife to a Catholic theologian. I have 5 children, one on the way, actually, who will be born in less than 8 weeks from now. So I'm very pregnant right now. And I homeschool. We live in Oxfordshire, England. We are from America, but we've had lots of travels due to my husband's work and studies. And I have always been Catholic. I grew up cradle Catholic when I was 7 years old. I had my first Holy Communion, and I decided that day that I would be a discalced Carmelite nun. That was decided very early on in my childhood. It obviously didn't work out. I've had such a love for Our Lady since the time I was a child, and so it came very natural to write this book, even though I had hesitancies to do it in the first place, because I wasn't sure that I had the confidence and the ability to write a book.
Well, it's a very good book, and it's very accessible. And one of the things you do is you, having introduced people to the particular theme of Our Lady's life, you then say, well, how might this translate into action for you? So in terms of pastoral commentary, 10 out of 10, that's very good. And will undoubtedly help people a lot. But I found, as an outsider coming in, that there are strange layers within the Catholic Church to do with Our Lady. I mean, in one sense, she's perfectly normal. Who but Catholics have such an instinctive and immediate response to her? But within the Church, it's almost as if there are, well, like an onion ring, there are inner rings. And in those rings, you find people with increasing devotion and understanding of Our Lady. So how did you make it from the outer rings into the inner ring? Was there anything particular, or was it just instinctively, you were born on October the 13th, so I guess that from the very early days, the connection between her apparition at Fatima and you was made clear. But
yes.
How did you make the journey from the outer ring to the inner ring?
It started in my childhood with just that, being born on October 13th and learning about Our Lady of Fatima. When my mom was pregnant with me, she went to a church and she was praying, and a man came up to her and said, "Your baby will be close to Our Lady." And at the time, she was just so shocked by that. So from the beginning, there was this connection there. But I would say throughout my childhood, I learned the Holy Rosary at age 10. I remember that. But I wasn't particularly pulled towards Our Lady in the way that I would pray to the Lord and pray to Jesus. And I really just grew in my faith. I think my teen years, I really was focused on the Lord. And it really came to this point of, in my adulthood, first of all, deciding to say the Holy Rosary every day. That in university, when I was 19, I made the decision to say the Rosary each day and for Lent. And then I just never stopped. Since then, I can't go to bed at night without saying it. So that was like the first step. And then I got engaged. And my husband and I, this is when I was 19. I'm saying, okay, I guess I'm learning a little bit about myself. So when my husband and I were engaged, we decided to consecrate ourselves to Our Lady, to Jesus through Mary, through the consecrations that St. Louis de Montfort, his preparations, the 33 days of preparations for consecration. And that was a turning point. That changed my life. There were big, just, I would say, knots in my life that just suddenly came undone. Things felt clear and peaceful. And we just saw such a blessing on our relationship and entering into marriage that just wasn't there before. It was just such a notable difference, her presence in our marriage. We went through grad school, and I say we because Josh was going through grad school, but I feel like I did it with him, you know, in many ways. Here and there, I would take a class, and he received his doctorate, and we were at Ave Maria University in Florida at the time. We were there for 5 years. It was so lovely. And during that time, actually, the woman who I dedicated the book to, Elizabeth O'Neill, I met her there. And she was just this beautiful mother. And she would just sacrifice in a way for her children that wasn't self-deprecating or in a sad way or self-pity. She just loved to serve everyone she was around and just so joyful, bringing life to everyone. And I just thought, this is the kind of woman I want to be. She reminds me so much of what Our Lady would be like. So again, that drew me closer. What brought about the book, how this all came to be, was we moved to Austria after Ave Maria to the International Theological Institute there. And when I was there, I was studying marriage and family graduate studies because we were living on campus. It was very easy to go to classes. And Josh was teaching and also getting a license in theology there. And during that time, I was just pondering the question of what it means to be a woman, especially in our times, and the complementary nature of man and woman, and what it meant to be a holy woman in modern times. Ultimately, it led me to the solution that the ultimate end of femininity is imitation of Our Lady.
That's extremely interesting, because one of the things we have to deal with is the way in which feminism, in its complex and different developments, has such a complete stranglehold on our atmosphere. So you would think that a woman of your age and of your stage of life would have been immersed in feminism, experiencing it very early on through the media, through contemporaries, almost like fluoride in the water. Were you ever influenced by secular feminism? Did you grow up in a particular bubble that saved you from it? But more importantly, how do you manage to cross this enormous barrier between the devotion to power that women have inherited from feminism, power, control, domination, and the virtues of Our Lady, which are simply the opposite, and therefore, at least in secular terms, enormously distasteful and unpopular at first sight? This is such a shift in culture. How have you negotiated it? And how do you help other people to negotiate it?
Well, I think first by the grace of God, because I see that it makes no sense that I would have these views and come to these conclusions. And I know it's by God's grace, because that's exactly right. Feminism is in the water. It's everywhere. And it's telling women, we're not enough, you know, and you need to do everything. You have to compete with men and be like men. And we lose our femininity in that, which is, I think, inherently this huge problem. When I was in university, I probably would have labeled myself as a Catholic feminist. I was studying political science.
Oh, really?
That's my background. I started working for the government when I was 16. My father's a diplomat. I put on suits. I went to work like I just was ready to go. You know, I was still discerning Carmel at that point as well, but it was kind of going off the back burner. And I realized I was meant to marry my husband, who I've known since I was 15. During that time, I just realized, okay, if we're going to be married, I want to be a mother. If we're going to be open to life and having all these children, I want to be present to them. And what does it mean to be a present mother? And I remember sitting down with Josh when we were engaged and saying, I don't want to work, actually. And I don't know where that came from, but it was there. And we decided, and we just made a decision together that through thick and thin, we'll just make it work for me to stay home with the children. God willing, if it works out, you know, everyone is in a different economic situation. That is the truth of it. But we've done our best to honor that decision that we made. I think, though, the lingering elements of feminism stayed with me, like this idea that I had to be something more or be strong, you know, and be less gentle and like kind of put away my sensitivity as a woman and my emotions. Now, it's true that a woman's emotions should be steeped in reason, but these sensitivities of the woman's heart, it's very good. And I started reading. I read my way into a hole. During our time in Austria, I started reading Edith Stein, Alice von Hildebrand, John Paul II, Gertrude von Lafort, Teresa of Avila. I just was digging. I just thought, what does it mean to be a woman? I want to be a holy woman. I want to be a virtuous woman. And I understand I can read Thomas Aquinas and learn about virtue, but what about femininity? This is my identity. And I believe we're going through an identity crisis.
I'm sure that's true. One of the things I want to bracket, it's always difficult to know which path to take in a conversation, but I'd just like to lay down a note to say, can we come back to Protestantism and give some thought to the fact that Protestantism has become such an easy casualty to a form of liberal anti-supernaturalism and power relations because it doesn't have Our Lady. It has no antidote, therefore, to the feminism in the water. Let's come back to that. What I'd like you to do, and I'll try not to make this sound like one of my old seminars when I was once a professor, but just give me a quick synopsis. A couple of minutes on Edith Stein, a couple of minutes on Gertrude von Lafort, on the Blessed Alice, on our dear JP2, and of course the most wonderful Thérèse of Avila, and why you haven't put in some other people, like Thérèse of Lisieux, for example. I mean, I would always personally jump for my gung-ho Teresa of Avila, but I know lots of people who are utterly dedicated to Thérèse of Lisieux. Anyway, let's begin.
Yeah, so Edith Stein, I read her Essays on Woman, and I was particularly struck and learned that every woman is called to be a mother, be it physical or spiritual. And I loved that she was a Carmelite nun, and she still was able to write so eloquently about the philosophy of motherhood. And she really empowers all women in their femininity because first of all, she was fighting feminism in Germany during that time, but she was showing that women don't have to lose their femininity in anything that they do, any work that they do. They should hold fast to their identity as women.
And she's an enormously powerful woman in her own right. I mean, intellectually, she's very tough indeed. I mean, not just intellectually, but I mean, the path her life took. You would never say that this is a soft, compliant person. She's as hard as nails. And it's extraordinary, I think, to find somebody with quite this, not pugnacious is the wrong word, but this muscular personality, so endowed with both rational intelligence and mystical insight, saying to women, you don't have to be a feminist to do this. I think she has an extraordinary influence on people. Did you come to her naturally, or was she presented to you to read? How did you find her?
Well, I was taking the marriage and family graduate courses, And I was digging into John Paul II at the time, and I knew, and I was starting to read some of his footnotes from different things that he'd write about women. I saw Edith Stein. I knew she was a Carmelite, and I have a very Carmelite heart. So I just went and I got her book.
Wonderful. Well, let's go to JP II himself then, because again, one of the things I liked about John Paul II, even before I became a Catholic, and if anyone could have made me a Catholic rationally, he would have done. But the process of becoming a Catholic is not only rational. Again, he's an enormously tough man, athletic, intellectually very rigorous. It's almost a surprise to see his tender appreciation, both emotionally and intellectually, for the feminine. So tell me what you found as you dug into JP II.
So originally I read Theology of the Body. And after that, I wanted to understand where he got all of his context for those audiences. So I went right to his source of Love and Responsibility. I took classes where we studied it. And that's where I was introduced to Love and Responsibility. And I was really struck most by the complementary nature of man and woman. So sort of looking at woman in relationship to man and what that looks like in this complementarity that we have. You know, he's so good about saying equal in dignity, but complementary in nature. And so I think he does an excellent job at showing the dignity of women and showing that being feminine isn't lesser than, you're not making yourself less human by honoring a man's place as being masculine, but it's actually this very beautiful part of what makes our world and the family really function well, and just men and women in general, the relationship function so well. So that's what I really loved about him. I did read his letter to women as well.
And it's very interesting that the secular world, because it's so completely fixated on equality, not that it understands equality, because equality is essentially a category given to numeric value rather than any other kind of aesthetic or philosophical value. But it's extraordinary that the world simply can't grasp complementarity. The very people who ought to do that, of course, are women, because women are more likely to be competent team players than men are. That's not a stereotype. That's simply to talk about the way in which we find ourselves fitting in to the biological roles that we inevitably enter, but then have to humanize and sanctify. I didn't know anything about Gertrude von der Fort. One can't know everything. You told me she's a philosopher. Tell me a bit more about Gertrude, and then we'll move on to her disciple, Alice von Hildebrand.
I fell upon Gertrude von der Fort through Alice von Hildebrand because I knew, I was again looking in those footnotes. I'm like, where is she getting these things from? What is their source, right? And one of Alice's sources is Gertrude von der Fort. She loves Gertrude von der Fort. And Gertrude von der Fort is a philosopher, a Catholic philosopher who wrote The Eternal Woman, which is essentially this book. It's a pretty small book, and it's all about Our Lady and how women are called to reflect Our Lady to the world. It's very heady. It's hard to read and understand. And it left me between her and Alice, and I'll get to this in a minute. They both kept saying that femininity, in the end, we need to imitate Our Lady, but then it would stop there. And so that's actually what brought me to write the book, is I wanted this practical on the ground, but how do we do that? So that's what Gertrude von der Fort did for me. I really prayed with what she said, very meditative as well, and academic, and just shedding light on good philosophy. I think that's what she does.
Alice von Hildebrand.
Alice von Hildebrand is probably my
She's
favorite.
She's such a pop.
Yeah. I love her. I wish I met her. I will, anything I can get my hands on that she writes, I read her interviews, her books, whatever it is. And I read The Privilege of Being a Woman at least once a year. It's all marked up, my book. And then also her book, Man and Woman, A Divine Invention, is excellent. She really just is unapologetically feminine, really talks about the issues of feminism, specifically this third wave of feminism, the attack on motherhood, how the devil is going to try to break down the family through the woman, because the woman is so privileged in her ability to be a mother, again, be it spiritual or physical. And what I find so striking again, I said this with Edith Stein, is Alice von Hildebrand. She was married, as you know, to another philosopher, but they couldn't have children. And yet she became a mother to so many of us reading her book. It's really striking how she could talk about motherhood and how it's this high calling of woman and all these different particular qualities of woman. She really grasps it, you know, being compassionate, sensitive, receptive, all of these things. And those are what I was looking for to answer my question, because they're on the ground, they're tangible. We can think like, oh, I have these gifts. Now I can tap into them now that I know them.
She's extraordinary. And like you, I try and get hold of anything I can that she's written. I was so interested that you put in Teresa of Avila, as I said earlier on, because I know this is a matter of personal taste and people are entitled to have their own tastes. But I don't hear many people talking about Teresa of Avila nowadays. She's almost like not a refined taste. I mean, yet it's surprising, really. You know, there's the humor of lying on her back in a river as she's been tipped into it by an accident, saying, Lord, if this is how you treat your friends, no wonder you've got so few of them. And this extraordinary ambition to go and single-handedly reform women's houses and succeed. And then, you know, her amazing friendship with the impenetrable John of the Cross. She is just the most fantastic woman. You've left a lot of women off your favorite list and put her on. Tell us a bit why.
So I'm going to tell you why, but then I have to tell you how Therese is involved in this book, because she's very involved. But yes, Teresa of Avila, her book, The Interior Castle, is, I think, what brought her to be on this list of what influenced this book so much, because she wrote this to her sisters in Carmel. She wrote this as to grow in holiness. And in that book, there's just so much little gems and treasures of understanding a woman's receptivity, especially in the spiritual life, and how a woman can grow in holiness. So this is like growth in prayer, growth in holiness, according to woman and her gifts. And I think that's what she hits on. And she's also this powerhouse of a woman, like you said, like she's strong, she's courageous, she's making waves, she's in making these changes to the Carmel and going back to something more intense for the Lord. And that's all very like using her feminine powers to do that. She did it in a woman's way. I think even her friendship with John of the Cross is just so beautiful because, again, that complementary aspect, like they're able to give in the friendship different strengths. So I just thought she had to be acknowledged specifically in the element of the spiritual life of woman.
I think it's not often recognized that it seems to me that in practice, women have a much more highly geared familiarity with life in the spirit. I don't think I'm just talking about my own personal limitations, but it does seem to me that men as a caste of mammal almost, we are so geared to resort to strength and fixing things and getting things done. It seems just an integral part of what it is to be a big person, as most men are. And that it's very difficult for men to shift our weight from self-reliance and the exercise of power to this very different enterprise, which is the life of the spirit, which women, perhaps because they're more physically vulnerable, but not only because of that, seem to have a much more highly attuned and instinctive sense of. Do you think that's true? And can you expand on that at all?
I definitely think that's true. And actually, I think Alice von Hildebrand really extends on this, but in a almost provocative way in talking about woman's weakness and how it's her strength, but she ties it into the gospel. And I think Teresa of Avila hits on this as well, is a woman is more naturally inclined to the spiritual life. And that's definitely in Interior Castle somewhere. But I think it has to do with exactly what Alice says, in entering into our weakness, understanding our neediness, before the Lord, and in that being able to receive so much and recognize that it's not coming from ourselves. This is just something very natural in woman. If there's a humility and receptivity there in the foundation, like sometimes we need to be healed in these areas, I think especially these days. But if we're aware of it, then we can grow in those things.
Okay, throw in Thérèse of Lisieux.
Okay, so you mentioned Thérèse, and I have to say her, the reason I call in the book, I end the whole book saying, with love, a little mother, pointing to myself as a little mother. And throughout the book, I talk about being a little woman, a little bride, a little mother, and it's all in light of Thérèse's little way, because I want when people to pick up this book, I'm looking down because I'm holding it. I want people not to be so intimidated by Our Lady's perfections, but to be really inspired by it and to recognize we can be little mothers. She is the mother, right? And we can imitate her in our little way in our daily lives. And all of that is Theresian inspired.
This sounds to me very important because women particularly, but not only women, obviously, but I think women particularly carry the burden of an expected perfectionism in themselves. It's made a great deal worse, of course, by our secular culture, which it seems to me lays an expectation of perfectionism on women in so many ways. It requires them to play all the different roles, and then there's this dreadfully pernicious matter of personal presentation and an embodiment of sexuality and beauty. It strikes me that there's something very important in what you said about Our Lady taking the perfectionist weight on herself. She does the perfectionism because she can. That's who she is. Is it then the case that if you have a proper relationship with Our Lady and you allow her to be who she is, that lets some of the rest of us off the hook?
I think that's exactly right. And I think that's such a beautiful insight and thought. I haven't thought of it in that way. That's very true, because the Lord doesn't expect us to be perfect. He made her perfect. But to be inspired by her draws us into the journey.
And wonderfully, I mean, she does it because she was made to do it. And I mean, ontologically, that's exactly who she is. And that's part of the beauty of her ontology. I want to go into two directions. One is I'd just like to ask you just to explain the progress of your book, the chapter headings. You take an aspect of Our Lady's being and her ministry, both ontology and function, and you just offer a little commentary and a way in. Tell us a bit how you saw yourself writing that, and is there anything that surprised you in the writing of it and that you particularly want to share, to get people maybe to have a look at the book itself out of curiosity?
The way I structured, I started writing the book, the idea came when I was living in Krakow, Poland, because after Austria, we moved to Krakow, and I was with my spiritual director there, and he said that you should write a book with some of these things in it. And the way I structured it was looking at St. Louis de Montfort's. I didn't want to take my own thoughts so much. You know, I wanted to try to gather together these things that I was reading and then things that were coming in prayer and that I would write down in adoration. You know, all of this I wanted to sort of put together in this book. And that's really what it is. It's the fruit of contemplation and study. And so I took St. Louis de Montfort's has coined 10 principal virtues of Our Lady. And so I took each of those virtues that traditionally we say that Our Lady has, and then I put it next to a quality of the feminine genius that I felt tied into that virtue, to give women something really tangible and practical to contemplate of like, okay, but how do I live this out? And so that was my goal, was that this is accessible. It's that you're taking these complex ideas and bringing them to reality to practically live them.
Well, and it works extremely well. And I mean, apart from anything else, it's a very balanced biography of Our Lady. I mean, a theological and spiritual biography. And I love the way that you end up with Our Lady, Queen of Heaven from the Apocalypse. Because, I don't know why I love it. It just I thought, I hope you go that far, and you did go that far. Anyway, so that's very helpful. I want to finish by asking you about a passion of mine, which is her apparitions. And again, you know, sometimes I see Catholics groan and raise their eyebrows. Oh, no, he's one of them. The apparition people are all a kind of another sub-onion ring in the whole thing. But it was really the apparitions that kicked me into a living relationship with Our Lady, because of the just the enormous discovery that the whole miracle of the marriage at Cana is reproduced every time she enters time and space in some kind of way. And no one who taught me theology ever introduced me to this wonderful third century apparition with Gregory the Wonder Worker, when Our Lady and St. John came and bearded him at a particularly critical moment in his life. And Garabandal happened when I was 9, and there were movie cameras, so I wanted to see those. And Zaytoun is one of the most interesting, because she says nothing, but yet thousands of Muslims were converted just by her hanging around on the spot, we believe, of where the Holy Family took refuge in Egypt. Tell me about your own relationship with the apparitions. Are there any that have particularly affected you, or any that you see, obviously Fatima because of your birthday, or any that you see as having particular purchase with what we're dealing with at the moment, which is this profound spiritual conflict between good and evil, centered, as you quite rightly, on the family of whom the woman is the natural guardian? Can you just tell us a little bit about, for my sake, about you and Our Lady and her apparitions?
Yes, I love learning about Our Lady and her apparitions. I have a particular fondness for Our Lady of Lourdes and also Our Lady of La Salette. I went there when I was a teenager and was very struck by her. Our Lady of Fatima is huge for me. I mean, obviously, because of the things we talked about, but also this book is for her. I mean, and it's for Our Lady of Sorrows. I write that as well. But when I was writing this, all I was thinking about is how the last battle is the battle for marriage and family. You take down the woman, you take down the family. So this is the battle of our times. We're in an identity crisis. Men don't know how to be men. Women don't know how to be women. We have these gender movements. We have transgenderism. We have all of these things. Our children are confused. You know, all of these things are coming up. And I think Our Lady of Fatima in particular, she told us this would happen, but she also told us that her immaculate heart would reign. So I remember when I finished this book, it was like throwing it at Our Lady and just saying, it's yours. Like, use it for your immaculate heart. You're like, please use it. Please, in my weakness, in my frailty, in my humanity, please use this for your immaculate heart, for the glory of your son and for heaven. I've been to Fatima before. I'm very moved by it. I feel so connected to it in our times. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about talking about femininity and continuing Alice von Hildebrand's mission. That's what I want to be to the world right now. I want to continue that on, because I think this is what Our Lady has warned us would happen.
Well, certainly somebody needs to carry on Alice von Hildebrand's work. And if it's you and any others, hooray. So the book is called Mary, Teach Me to Be Your Daughter, Finding Yourself in the Blessed Mother. Megan Madden, thank you so much for coming and talking about it a bit, sharing something of your own journey and sharing something of the enormous importance of what it is to be a Catholic, because we have access to Our Lady in this particular way. And as you quite rightly say, the way to take down the whole of Christendom, the whole of humanity, is to take out the mother, the woman, and then everything falls apart. So for your own part in helping restore that, thank you. It's been really great delight to talk to you.
It's been so lovely to be here. Thank you so much for having me.